Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. To paraphrase George Gershwin, summertime and the living may be easy, but chances are it's not too healthful. The American Association of Pediatrics says high ozone levels threaten our children's health. Also this time, George Jetson, also known as Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, with a strange-looking machine. And eco-linking, online with the world, says computer whiz Don Rittner.
Yeah, eco-linking is sort of a process of using personal computers to be able to correspond and work with environmentalists around the world and without actually leaving their home or office.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. It may be just the worst news parents and children could hear. Children, stay inside on a summer afternoon. Bad though it may be, this was just the message given recently by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Ruth Etzel is a member of the Academy's Committee on Environmental Health.
What we'd like parents to be aware of is that levels of ozone, which many children may experience during the summer in the United States, can be hazardous to their health, and that parents should be aware that there are certain times of day when ozone is much higher than at other times of day. It tends to peak in the mid to late afternoon. So if children are exercising, they could prevent excessive exposure to ozone by exercising earlier in the day.
In addition to serving on the Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Etzel is chief of the Air Pollution and Respiratory Health Branch of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Dr. Etzel says the concern here is for high levels of what is called ground-level ozone.
It is a respiratory irritant. It reacts with the tissue and fluid lining the airways of the lung. Some people think of it like a sunburn for your lung.
For the past 6 years or so, we have increased our attention and level of concern for levels of ozone, both the ground-level kind and the ozone in the upper-level atmosphere, which forms a protective layer about 25 miles above Earth. Ozone at both levels is the same compound. The difference is how it reacts with the surrounding atmosphere, says Jeffrey Clark with the EPA's Office of Air Quality Planning and Standards.
What we have down here where we breathe the air, particularly in urban areas, is a problem that's predominantly a summertime problem. There are a number of chemicals, volatile organic compounds, which are emitted from a variety of sources, evaporating fuels, tailpipe emissions from automobiles, refueling emissions from automobiles, industrial sources, even things like backyard barbecue, lighter fluids, oil-based paints, a number of very, very small sources as well as large sources. Those volatile organic compounds go up into the air. They mix with nitrogen oxides, which also come from automobile tailpipe emissions, from power plants, from industrial boilers, things like that. Those volatile organic compounds and the nitrogen oxides go up in the air. They mix in the presence of heat and sunlight and form ozone, which is the primary constituent of smog.
It stands to reason, then, that ozone smog air pollution is highest in the more densely populated, industrialized areas of the country.
You'll see areas like Los Angeles, California, that has, you know, very high or has high levels of ozone for a large number of days, on the order of, you know, 130, 140 days a year. Other cities around the country, in fact, there's 96 cities that have an ozone problem right now. 96 areas, actually, it's broader than cities. And Los Angeles is the worst. There's a group of cities: New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Houston, Milwaukee, that are sort of the next tier. But it's a broad-reaching problem, I guess, down at the ground level.
While many federal and state laws now are beginning to set controls and cleanup measures in these high-risk areas, Dr. Etzel says the immediate problem is that federal standards are not inclusive enough.
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics has suggested that the federal ambient air standard for ozone contains little or no margin of safety for children who are engaged in active outdoor activity. And we would hope that the federal government would take children into consideration as it revises the ozone standard.
The current national ambient air quality standard is 0.12 parts per million. Though this is too high, says Etzel, the American Academy of Pediatrics is not taking the position of recommending specific reductions. Just that 0.12 parts per million is too much. Clark at the EPA says his agency is addressing the issue in a variety of ways.
The Clean Air Act of amendments of 1990 took these 96 ozone areas and divided them up into different categories and gave different deadlines for different ones and different requirements for different ones. And broadly, it's five categories. The first category is marginal areas, the ones that are very close to meeting the standard. Of those areas, and there's about 40 of them, they are required to meet the standard by November of 1993. The next category up, the moderate areas, November of 1996. The so-called serious areas, the next category, November of 1999. There's eight areas that are the severe category, 2005-2007 time frame, and then Los Angeles by 2010.
Clark says the latest data coming in from these areas shows that overall, with reductions in tailpipe emissions and scrubbers on industrial smokestacks and the like, we are making progress toward reducing air pollution, bringing more and more areas under the 0.12 ppm standard. Kansas City, as we reported last year, became the first in the nation to take itself off the EPA list of cities below acceptable standards by cleaning up its air pollution. Still, the issue is not cleaning up air pollution and bringing more regions under the law. The issue, from the Academy of Pediatrics and others, is that the 0.12 ppm standard, established in 1979, is too high. Clark says the EPA is aware of changes which nearly 15 years can make. However, for the time being, he says,
we pretty much have a two-prong approach. One is to fully implement the Act as it is, because a lot of the requirements that we're putting into place under the Act get reductions in places that are not just non-attainment areas. A lot of the tailpipe reductions, the automobile evaporative controls, things like that, get reductions on a national basis, and will help in areas, in the kind of areas that you're talking about as well. The second prong is the second piece of it is that you're exactly right that we are concerned about new data that have been coming to light over the last several years. The last revision that we did, last sort of decision that we made, to maintain the standard as it was on the I believe it was 1988, and what we're doing now is putting together, going through our whole scientific review process that's laid out in the Clean Air Act to look at all of the data that have come into us since that time.
Dr. Etzel says the recent study has focused on children for good reason.
First, they breathe more rapidly, and therefore they inhale more pollutants for each pound of their body weight than do adults. They're outside more often. They're often engaged in more vigorous activity than adults. And they also have smaller, narrower airways. And so irritation that in an adult may produce only a slight response could result in significant obstruction for the smaller airways of a young child.
Though there is a group called the Clean Air Science Advisory Committee in place to review the standards and recommend changes, Clark says perhaps we should be looking at the problem from a different angle.
The 0.12 number that I gave you earlier was it's a one-hour exceedance. Maybe the concern should be that not that somebody breathes something for 1 hour that's higher than 0.12, but maybe it should be that somebody's breathing something lower than 0.12, say 0.10 or whatever, 0.09 or some lower level, but at a for a longer period of time.
So is the EPA agreeing with the American Academy of Pediatrics in warning about high levels of ozone? Clark says,
I guess it depends very much on where you live.
The recommendation, read your local newspaper or tune into the Evening News, Weather, Sports, and Ozone Report. Jeffrey Clark, Special Assistant to the Director of the Office of Air Quality Planning and Standards of the Environmental Protection Agency at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, and Dr. Ruth Etzel on the board of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She spoke to us from her offices at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. This is Bruce Robertson. How much does it cost you to mow your lawn? The mower itself, the gas and oil, yearly maintenance. Now, how much does running your lawnmower cost the planet? Good question. One, in fact, probably few of us have considered, let alone answered. But it is one question Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, considered and answered when he bought his newest lawnmower. He said, come on over for a demonstration. So here we are.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Okay, let me walk along here with you.
All right. How do you like my new machine?
Well, I can tell you're mowing your lawn, Larry, but I've got to tell you, this is the strangest looking mower I've ever seen. You kind of look like George Jetson out here.
Yeah, it's a new electric lawnmower now, and it's a cordless electric lawnmower. It's a new machine by Ryobi Company. It's called a Mulchinator, and it's a new breakthrough kind of machine because it's electric. And it's cordless, you don't run over the cord, and it has enough power to really apparently get the job done. I think electric lawnmowers used to have problems in the past. And of course this, cuts down on air pollution, and it does a real good job cutting my lawn.
Yeah, we gotta talk about that, air pollution. Of course, running it on electricity is different than running on gasoline, but what are the choices there? I mean, it's a dilemma there, isn't it? I mean, burning gasoline in the fossil fuels versus
right.
using the electricity in the fossil fuel from the power plant?
Well, they've done an analysis of this, and a lawnmower, when it runs for an hour, gives off 6 pounds of carbon dioxide. An electric lawnmower, let's pretend like you're hooking it up to a power plant, gives off 1 pound of carbon dioxide, and that's given off at the power plant. So right in your own yard, you're not giving off anything, but you know, in the whole universe, you are giving off 1 pound of carbon dioxide, which is a significant reduction. And then, of course, it only costs about $4 a year for the electricity to charge this thing. It doesn't demand a lot of power. It's just a trickle charge for the battery. Once you've cut the grass, I think one charge will last you about 60 minutes. Once you've run it down, then you just plug it in and leave it charged up. It takes about 16 hours to charge up the machine, and then you're ready to go again.
I see on the top of this it says a Mulchinator. What's that?
Well, this is another thing that's good about this machine is that it's a mulching lawnmower. Now, we've had mulching lawnmowers around for a few years. Most of them have been power mowers. The original mulching mowers were just too low in horsepower. They didn't do a good job. then they made them with bigger horsepower. Now they finally have an electric one that has enough horsepower to mulch the grass. And by that, I mean that it cuts it and recuts it and then drives it down into the turf so that you don't track the lawn clippings into the house anymore. They decompose and become a real good source of nitrogen.
How does it do that? Is it the blades under the underside look differently? Or
yeah,
they're
sort of twisted. The blades have sort of a twisted look to them. It still looks flat and horizontal, but they have a little bit of a twist to them. The cutting chamber inside underneath the mower itself is enhanced so that the grass clippings will stay in there and be cut two or three times before they're finally blown down into the turf. And it's interesting, these mulching mowers, naturally you don't have to send grass clippings to the landfill anymore. So that's significant. There's lots of states now that ban grass clippings. As I said, the grass clippings can be a significant source of nutrients. Nitrogen. All lawns have to have nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. If you cut the grass with a mulching mower, you get nitrogen from the grass clippings. In the fall, if you cut the mow up a few of your leaves, you get a significant source of phosphorus, which is good for root growth of your grass. And if you empty your wood stove out on your back lawn, just a light dusting, wood stove's ashes are a significant source of potassium. So you get all three of them. So nature has given us the means to take care of our lawns naturally if we just don't get in there and mess it up.
So you're sold on this electric lawnmower concept,
yeah,
huh?
I like it, yeah? Because, it, first of all, it's really space age. I really dig the look of it. And also, it's electric. It's not noisy. I don't have to worry about oil, putting it, all that stuff with a power mower. So I like this machine.
Finally, on a practical note, how long would this run? How large of a lawn would this do on a one charge?
Well, you get about 60 to 90 minutes out of a charge, which is will handle the average good-sized lawn that you would cut with a power mower, with a push mower. They don't have a riding mower in this type yet. So if your lawn mower was big enough that you'd need a riding mower, this mower might be just a little bit too small for that.
But what about depth of grass?
Well, you want to cut grass about 3 inches, always, and then never let it grow real tall. Never let it grow more than another inch before you cut it. Always follow the 1/3 rule. Also, with mulching mowers, you never really want to cut the grass when it's wet. But that's a general rule of thumb for cutting grass almost all the time anyway.
Well, Larry, I can tell this is a toy for you, so
yes.
I'll let you get back and play, although you're working hard at work here,
yeah,
mowing your lawn. So get back to work with the electric lawnmower.
Yes, and I think I'll see Buck Rogers a little bit later.
Okay, take care.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. Somke keeps his electric lawnmower all charged up at his home in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. Ecolinking is a relatively new tool being used by environmentalists from Chicago to Moscow.
Yeah, ecolinking is sort of a process of using personal computers to be able to correspond and work with environmentalists around the world and without actually leaving their home or office.
Don Rittner, author of the popular book Ecolinking, goes online from his home office in Schenectady, New York. Rittner says we may communicate with the world by using a personal computer, a device known as a modem, basically a telephone, and a variety of computer networks.
And what it does is really allow environmentalists to connect up to about 40 million people in over 100 countries. So anyone that has a personal computer and a modem and access to a phone line can participate in this sort of global networking.
To some degree, Buckminster Fuller's global village has now become just a neighborhood.
Well, of course, people are now beginning to realize that environmental crises are global. What happens in one part of the world affects us in the other parts of the world. And what ecolinking allows you to do is be able to work and form coalitions with environmentalists around the world to work on global issues, not just local issues. For the last, say, 15, 20 years, most of the environmental actions have been sort of local or regional conflicts. And it's only been the last, say, 5 years where the sort of scientific evidence has been showing, particularly in global warming, issues like that, destruction of the rainforest, that all these, while they may be regional, are affecting environmental degradation around the world. What you can do now is organizations, individuals, scientists, students, almost anyone with access to a personal computer can link up with people working on similar goals. So, for example, the rainforest is in many parts of the world, and those who are working on protecting the rainforest can talk to each other and share information, reports, research, without actually having to physically meet in any location. They can use computer resources by sending the information over the phone line.
Rittner says we don't have to wait for the next annual conference on this or that topic either.
This is instantaneous. When you send information across the wire, it gets there within seconds rather than days or weeks using the conventional mail routes.
Rittner says there has been a virtual explosion in the number of people now online.
When I started networking, there were only, say, a few thousand people online. And now estimates are up to 40 million people are now using this information technology. And it's growing by leaps and bounds. For example, the Internet, which is a large conglomerate of networks, that connects up to over 80 countries and basically sponsored by the U.S. government. The Internet is actually increasing 15% in size every month. It's going to double, and it already has 17, 18 million people on it.
Rittner mentioned Internet. This is just one of the program networks now eco-linking people. There are many others.
For example, there are over 100 of the top libraries in the world which are available online. And there's a process called telnetting, or remote logon, where here I am in Schenectady, New York, and I can sign on to a library in Brussels, Belgium, and thumb through their card catalog as though I was standing right there in their lobby doing it. So there are tremendous amounts of online library research information for people. There are all kinds of databases. For example, those who are working in toxics can search the EPA toxic inventory by signing onto a database and looking for whatever chemicals are looking for, again, without leaving their home or office.
Not only is it possible to thumb through the card catalog in Brussels, Belgium, Brittner says many new relationships may be started in this crowd of 40 million.
This includes scientists, business people, military academics, you know, the whole gamut. What's great about this is that you could correspond with these people, and they don't ask you if you're a PhD, they don't ask you who you are. And so I've formed relationships with people in Moscow, Ankara, Turkey, Sydney, Australia, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Japan. These are people I'll probably never, ever see in person. And yet I have these great friendships now with fellow environmentalists around the world. And to me, that's the most important thing. Is the human, the one-on-one contact that you can make.
Getting online today is easier and cheaper than you would think.
What you need is access to a personal computer. You don't have to own it, although it's certainly a lot easier if you own one. The prices of personal computers today are tremendous. The prices keep dropping almost every month. And so you can get almost a complete setup, which includes the computer, a modem, and then you already have your phone line and the communication software for $1,500 or less. So that's a really, really good investment.
With your equipment set up, Brittner says you have a choice of four network categories to join. The global network, such as Internet that we mentioned earlier, commercial networks such as CompuServe, Econet, and America Online. Then there are private or individual bulletin boards. And finally, there is a technology called CD-ROM, basically a compact disc that can store information.
And the compact discs are just like your music CDs, except instead of having music on them, they've got information. And you can put about 250,000 pages of information on one CD. So those are very good for bibliographies or statistics research results.
The global networks are usually free. The commercial networks usually charge an hourly fee. But whether it is free or you pay, the process is similar. For example,
on America Online, there's the environmental forum, so that you can actually go and join, become a member of this national environmental forum, and you can ask questions or you can read information, you can download information and files to your own computer, and participate in weekly conferences, you know, with guest speakers or other environmentalists.
Services such as America Online also act as a general reference source.
And, you know, for example, if you're only interested in, organizations that work on farms, so you could do a search, and here you come up with the American Farmland Trust. All right, so, again, it's a way of quickly getting information, and today, you know, time is money. And so you're trying to get information as fast as you can.
Don Rittner, his book, Ecolinking, is published by Peach Pit Press, Berkeley, California. Rittner is online from his upstate New York home office in Schenectady, New York. This is Bruce Robertson.
You could be a botanist in the rainforest somewhere, and by using one of these computers and a cellular modem, you can actually call up the Internet, and it basically bounces off a satellite, get your email, or, again, do online research in some library looking for information, and you can be, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles away from any kind of urban population.
That's our report on the Environment Show this week. Thanks much for joining us, the Environment Show, a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. We had help this week from Jim Ormond. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for the Environment Show, program number 182. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.